Okay, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. And tonight we are going to begin to climb the ladder of trust. This is part one in the trust ladder. And specifically, we kind of codenamed tonight's class, Born Innocent. And we're going to learn some very interesting things about B'tochen. So let me just give a little bit of a preface. The truth is that this lesson is a little bit of a standalone. It's not like a continuation. The first five lessons of the seventh chapter of Shara B'tochen were really a continuation. Essentially, Rabbeinu Bachaya was demonstrating how certain things are necessarily going to become an impediment to the attaining and maintaining of B'tochen. If you're not going to get these things right, you're not going to be able to have B'tochen. It's actually that simple. You have to have the right ideas, you have to have the right focus, you have to have the right faith system, you have to have the right cradle, you have to have the right understanding. If you have an understanding, then you have faith. If you don't have an understanding, if you don't have the faith basics down pat, how are you going to have B'tochen? B'tochen, after all, is trust in Hashem, but if you don't know what you're believing in, and don't know what you're supposed to trust, or where you're supposed to place your trust, how would it be possible? And of course, the answer is that it wouldn't. Initially, Rabbeinu Bachaya spoke about a number of things which are impediments to faith in general, if you're lacking these things. Then he spoke about specific obstacles to developing B'tochen itself. And we kind of concluded that in the previous episode. So now, Rabbeinu Bachaya is going to apply this, and he's going to demonstrate to us how there is a ladder with 10 rungs of B'tochen. And we start off at the very lowest level of B'tochen. But here's the funny thing. It's borderline strange, but I'm going to give you my understanding of it. The first five rungs are actually a lack of B'tochen, or B'tochen doesn't like make its way in. Initially, born innocent, we can't know any better, but later on, we should know better, and we don't. We don't. And the first five levels have nothing to do with B'tochen and Hashem. If anything, as we start moving up those rungs, by the time we get to level four, we're going to see how the lack of B'tochen is a demerit, is a negative, because it's a total lack of B'tochen. So it's not really ten rungs in B'tochen. The first five rungs are not rungs in trust in Hashem altogether. And it's going to begin with the simple innocence of a baby who trusts that he's going to get the source of sustenance before he even understands that he has a mother. When all he knows is that he has breasts to suckle from. That's all he gets. He doesn't even know there's a mother behind that. So obviously the baby couldn't know any better. What is Rabbeinu Bachaya's point? And I think that his point is, he wants to show us now how this idea that he discussed earlier, that knowledge and understanding and comprehension and an affiliation and an appreciation of Hashem's omnipotence and of Hashem's continued ongoing engagement with our world, all the ideas that we believe in, the concept of Hashgacha Pratis, he wants to show us that understanding these things necessarily leads us to trust in Hashem. And lack of understanding is going to detract from that. Like, why does he have to spell it out so clearly? So I think the answer is this, and I don't know this for sure, but this is just my hunch. I think that if you will ask the average person, is trust, which is, you know, kind of like in the realm of faith, is that the born of rhyme and reason and rationality, or is it transcendent of rhyme, reason, and rationality? You have to like answer that question simply. Trust makes sense or it doesn't make sense? I think the answer would be it doesn't make sense. It's transcendent of, it's not like an equation. You could do the equation and then you come with here's the conclusion. This makes sense, and that makes sense. So now I understand that Hashem is going to take care of me. No, I don't think so at all. In fact, faith, trust in Hashem, is not in the mind. It's like a heart thing. It's like a feeling. It's like being certain, being sure, right? This is the idea of the concept of faith. It's transcendent. So there's what's called the baseline is the intellectual kind of approach to things. That's a baseline. Doing things which are foolish, forgive me, stupid, is beneath that line. It's beneath that line. And then we can rise above that line. And that's called like piety. It's called almost holiness. It's called transcendence. To transcend everyday rhyme and reason. You can't come to this conclusion by virtue of what we're going to call cold calculating intellect. It's a leap beyond. So it's not stupidity, because stupidity is unwise. But this is not unwise. This is not dumb. This is an act of faith. It's an act of faith. It's transcendent of rhyme and reason. So how would rhyme and reason feed into something which is inherently transcendent of it?
Say it again.
I'm going to say that again. I know it sounds like word salad. Let me rephrase it. If I would ask you, is rhyme and reason, like understanding, is that going to lead you to faith? The simple answer to that question, no, it's not about rhyme and reason. And yet, somehow Rabbeinu Bachai is maintaining that the rhyme and reason is what leads us to faith. And the lack of understanding and the lack of knowledge and the lack of intellectual clarity is going to detract from faith. So he says, like, one second, how does that work? Why does intellectual clarity, why does understanding something, why does comprehension necessarily have this elemental connection to the concept of faith? Do you understand what I'm asking? Like, it sounds somewhat oxymoronic, but it isn't. It isn't. Why? Because you have to understand what we're talking about. Rabbeinu Bachai is going to show us how an awareness of circumstances and situation enables us to get past the folly of what appears to be and to understand things in a deeper way. But you can't get past the folly of what seems to be unless you have a clear grasp of what really is. And then you can have like a leap beyond. You can come to the conclusion in a logical way that something otherworldly is at play. I once was at a Fabrengen with Abiel Kahn. And Abiel shared something very interesting. He said that there was a fellow who came to him who said that he was having, I use the vernacular, sveikus in emunah. He was having these doubts. He was plagued with doubts. There is a God. There isn't a God. Did Moshe Rabbeinu really get the Torah of mitzvahs? Did he really? Yeah, sveikus in emunah. And this person came to Rabbi Yael Kahn because he was this tremendous sage and scholar and teacher of Hasidus, and he said to have helped many people. And he said to him, like, I have these sveikus in emunah. So Rabbi Yael asked him, do you ever learn any Hasidus? He said, no, we don't do that. You know. So like, you know, we'd learn Gemara and like. And he wasn't like open. He wasn't open to learning the certain rigors of learning Hasidus. You have to be familiar with language and system, because Hasidus utilizes much of the terminology and the phraseology and the systemization of Torah that's found in Kabbalah. So like, and he was like, no, I'm not up to that. So Rabbi Yael asked him, do you ever learn the Rebbe's Sichas? The Rebbe's less formal teachings, not the Maimarim, not the Chassidus, but the Sichas, what the Rebbe asks and explains a whole bunch of things about the Torah mitzvahs. And he said, no. So Rabbi Yael said to him, I was just starting to learn the Rebbe's Sichas. So he started to learn the Rebbe's Sichas. And he came back to Rabbi Yael. And again, I remember just as a yeshiva student sitting by a Fabrengen, Rabbi Yael sharing this. And he says, a very strange thing is happening, he says. All of the Rebbe's Sichas make perfect sense. They're very logical analyses of a wide range of Torah subjects. And it all makes perfect sense to me. But he says, my sveikus and emunah are going away. My doubts are suddenly disappearing. Like, I feel certain, he says. I don't feel those doubts anymore. In other words, there's like an element of the logic of Torah that enables us to kind of leap beyond logic. And the problem is, and I think this is already 1,000 years ago in the time of Rabbeinu Bachai, but certainly in today's day and age, where people will say, no, I don't want to understand, I don't want to plumb into these deep things. I'm going to stick to basics. I have emina tohoida to tell you. I have pure faith. I don't need to understand about godliness. I have pure faith. But it's juvenile and it's foolish, because what happens is, when you use faith where you're supposed to be using intellectuality, then you burn out your engine. You're not supposed to be using faith here. Here you can actually understand it. Faith is where understanding ends. But when you apply faith where understanding should be, then when you need faith, you've already spent the fuel. You're not able to get past that. You have to first maximize with our minds what we can possibly understand, and only then can we take a leap into faith and trust in Hashem. I think that's a little bit of what's going on here. You'll forgive me for sharing my own ideas a little bit, but that's how I understand this. You'll see. We'll learn together. You see if you agree with me. I think this is a helpful way to approach the subject, especially because tonight we're not actually talking about faith per se. Not trust in Hashem, at least. These are paradigms of trust, examples of trust, and examples of how knowledge leads to a greater trust, albeit misplaced. And from there, we'll shatter the glass ceiling. But that'll be already the next episode. So if you're following along in the Kihat book, we're on page 241. It's where it says the progress of trust. Progress of trust. And it goes like this. Uchloloi shel davar. Uchloloi shel davar. So here is the rule. Here's the rule. That is to say, that up until now, we focused on the obstacles, the things that get in the way of attaining and maintaining the concept of trust in Hashem. Failing to appreciate the meaning of Hashem's power in the world, the meaning of Hashgacha Pratis, the cause and effect that we learned about in the previous episode, is basically going to be detrimental. It's going to stunt the development of your emunah. Have your betachin. So now Rabbeinu Bechaya will illustrate how the more one recognizes Hashem's presence and the more one has a deeper understanding, the more he or she is able to advance in the arena of betachin. And like I said, it'll begin. This is the klal shel davar. This is the rule. The rule is that by virtue of understanding and having clarity about what is and isn't, we're able to reach that level of transcendence. So, klal shel davar, be'inyan ha-bitachon. I think this is the first time in the entirety of the book that we came across such a phrase, klal shel davar. The general rule. Here is the general principle. Here is the rule. This is across the panorama of bitachon. This is the rule of bitachon. The rule of betachin is, ki yisrein ha-betachin, that if we're going to speak about the more virtuous betachin, talking about a higher, more intense, more profound, and greater degree of betachin. So yisrein ha-betachin, mei ha-betchim belekim, if you want to know how the more profound betachin is developed amongst the trusters, amongst those who have trust, amongst those who place their trust in Hashem. If you want to know who places his or her trust best, so the general rule is that it's kfi yisrein yidiyosa maisa. It comes in accordance with how well they know him. The better you know him, the more betachin you're going to have. The less you know of him and about him, the less betachin you're going to have. In other words, your knowledge, your understanding will lead you to transcend. But if you don't have knowledge and understanding to begin with, what do you transcend? So this will lead you in that direction. Ve'emunosam ba'agonosi aleihem, the more we have what we would call a sense of faith and conviction in Hashem's shielding us and protecting us, so the more that we have that, the more we understand and appreciate HaKadosh Baruch Hu's divine providence, his Hashgacha Pratis, that Hashem is engaged and involved with every little iota, every little detail of our life, the more we understand that, and the clearer we are about that, so the more profound and the more powerful, the greater will be the level of our betachin. More understanding, more betachin. And as I mentioned at the outset, this is almost like an oxymoron. More understanding, more betachin. It's not understanding. It's transcendent of understanding, indeed. But understanding is what gets us there. So that's the rule. That's the general. And this is about, this first sentence is about B'tochen. But now we're going to start climbing the ladder. And in this ladder, we're going to talk about the 10 different levels. We're going to illustrate this idea that Rabbeinu Bechai is now proposing, namely that the more one appreciates Hashem's omnipotence, the more one is aware and mindful of Hashem's engagement and involvement with everybody's life and how Hashem is the ultimate prime mover and the cause of all that happens, the more we understand this, the more it's clear to us, so the greater will be the level of our betachen. But on the first five levels that we're going to talk about now as we climb this ladder, we're not even talking about betachen and Hashem at all, which is quite surprising. But before you go to sleep, and just stay awake, because there's going to be one very, very important little detail in betachen that I think gets slipped in here. He slips it in between the lines. He slips in something extremely powerful. It fits right in. But it's he slips it in, and it's in the midst of talking about trust, which is non-trust in Hashem, he slips in this very powerful message about betachen, as you will see. Okay, v'hine. Hayelad, little baby, betchilas inyane, betchilas inyane is the beginning of his being, the first stages of existence. I talk about infancy, first moments of life. So, what does he trust in? Where does he place his reliance?
On the mother.
He doesn't even know his mother exists. Does he understand what a mother is? We're talking about a baby that's a few hours old. What is the baby looking for? Food. Food. A human being somehow inherently knows they need food. In the womb, he has an umbilical cord, and he's fed. And he doesn't get hungry. Unless the mother doesn't eat. And then he gets very hungry. But if the mother's eating, he's fine. And it's not a secret that when women fast, Yom Kippur, you know, the babies get uppity. And there's even evidence, there's a 2% rise in statistical births in Israel the day after Yom Kippur. 2%. So people say, if you fast, you go into labor. There's no science behind that, or barely any science. 2%. They looked at the records very carefully. Mother goddess. I don't know what you're talking about. So the child is fed, he's happy. He's happy. Then he's thrust into this cold, scary world. And the child all of a sudden feels like he's flying free and he's terrifying. So before he's all bunched up. That's what little babies like to be, swaddled, and wrapped up and held very tight to keep warm. He's thrust into this freezing, cold, terrifying world. And he knows he needs to eat very, very soon. So what does the baby do? The baby bonds with the mother. But he's not really bonding with his mother. He just knows that he could suckle his mother's breast. That's all he knows. He figures out at a certain point that if he sucks that, he's going to get milk. That's what he figures out. So what does the baby know? The baby knows that he has breasts to rely on. That's all he knows. He doesn't have to know anything else. He's got to find the nipple and get it in his mouth and everything's going to be fine. And maybe he figures it out in the first half hour of his existence or the first 2 hours or 3 hours, and then he knows. And then he cries and that's all he wants. Get me back to the bosom, get me back to the breast, and I can suckle and that's it. That's all the baby knows. Now, David HaMelech actually uses this metaphor. It's a very powerful metaphor. And David HaMelech uses it when he wants to describe and demonstrate the concept of trust. K'moshe Ne'emar, like it says, this is found in Psalm 22, in the 10th verse, which is an incredible chapter of Tehillim. Altogether, this is the prayer of Esther as she's walking into the throne room and sees her life flashing before her. And is filled with a message of trust in Hashem. She's like stealing herself with trust. And in verse 10, the psalmist says, "Kata goichi mi beten imi, you enable me to emerge from my mother's womb." But that's not what Rabbeinu Bechai quotes here. "Mavtichi al shdei imi, I rely, I have my surety is upon my mother's breasts." That's what the baby knows. As Rashi points out, Zimanta la'odom shidayim lishoin aleim lemichya. Hashem arranges the mother's breasts so that the child can rely upon this for food. Obviously, the baby can't speak, but if you think the baby understands that there's a human being behind those things, I don't think so. The baby just knows he's looking to suckle. That's all. He's looking for Shdayime. He's not looking for anything else. And as long as he has that, so then he's happy. Miftachi. Miftachi is like from the word betachin, to be secure, to be guaranteed. The Metzudas David says, Mimcho hiftachti, from you I learned what the meaning of trust. Lishoin al Shdayimi. He relies on his mother's breasts to be nourished by her milk. That's all the baby knows. And it's a paradigm of trust. So that's what the baby's full reliance on. He doesn't know from anything else. Then what happens? Then the baby at a certain point figures out that his mother is not just a milk machine. That there's a person here. There's this woman who is his mother who cares about him. Who's devoted to him. So, Rabbeinu Bechaya says, Chasher techezak hakarosei, as his recognition grows, as his awareness and his perception begins to develop, and it gets a little sharper, it gets a little better, and it improves. So then, meshiv bitchoinei alimai, he relies on his mother. He finds comfort in his mother. The baby just wants to know where his mother is. As long as mommy's there, I'm okay. Mommy's my protector. That's what he's looking for. His mother, that's where he places his trust. And this is not because his mother is a milk machine. At a certain point, it goes beyond simply suckling. At a certain point, the child feels a sense of comfort as long as his mother's around. If he's bereft of his mother, separated from his mother, then he has separation anxiety, then he gets very nervous. This is also alluded to in Tehillim. These are the most powerful examples of trust, where a child trusts implicitly the fact that his mother's there, the child is gone. The moment the mother's gone, the child is lost. So this goes forward to Psalm 131. Over there, in Kapitel Kuf Lamed Aleph, David HaMelech says, Im lo yishi visi v'deimamti nafshi, Kgomul alei imoi, kgomul alei nafesh. So David HaMelech says that he's talking about trust over here. And the translation, as they put it in the Kihat edition, is that he likens his soul to a child just weaned from his mother, like a child just weaned is my soul. Just weaned means the child has been fed by his mother and now places his trust in his mother. And the child feels good in the presence of the mother. He's calm. The mother's not there, the child is lost. And we use this as an example. The just weaned mother, that is actually the example of pure trust. So, for example, the weaned toddler has some measure of independence, yes? Yet he always remains very close to his mother. He relies on his mother for security and guidance and support. Maybe he's eating solids. Maybe he's not breastfeeding anymore. But the child just wants to know his mother's there. The mother's there, and the child is calm. And the mother's not there, and the child is lost. Anybody's ever seen, like when a Rahman al-San, a mother gets sick and separated from the children, it's a very painful, very difficult experience for the baby. So once again, David HaMelech has demonstrated that we use this example of pure and perfect trust of a baby who trusts in the mother. Now, after we've moved through those initial two rungs of trust, the question is, does the child still find what we're going to call a sense of security only in his mother? At a certain point, the child feels that he needs a protector. And the protector the child feels is his daddy, his big, strong daddy. That's the protector. So something changed in the child. Let's take a look in the Mefarshim, just in this opening two rungs. The Neder Bakedish says, Klali Shaldavar, what is this? What is the Mechaber? What is the author trying to do here? He says, Reitze laharis lanu eser kedushay sumayles min abeitchem. He's trying to demonstrate to us that there are 10 rungs of trust. And he wants to show us the virtue of one over the other. What does he want to show? Why does he want to show us the virtue of one level of trust over the other? Because the virtue of each level comes out of knowledge. More knowledge, more trust. So as the perception widens and deepens, the trust all of a sudden is enhanced and elevated. In other words, the degree of the trust is in perfect corollary with the amount of knowledge and comprehension in accordance with perception. That's the point over here. So he says, you have to understand that when a person is going to have trust in HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Hashem, so the virtue will also be in accordance or in corollary with the amount of knowledge and perception. As the Marpel in Nefesh says, the Raya Muchachas, what's the proof that this is in fact true? So Rabbeinu Bachaya illustrates it in the most lucid way. He says, you see that a yelad betchilo, that the child in the beginning is betech al shidei imoy. Initially, he places his trust and his security in his mother's breasts that he can suckle. Va'acharkach, and then afterwards, he feels secure when he's around his mother. Va'acharkach, and then as the child grows older, then the child places his trust and feels secure when he is with his father. When there's the protector. And this is the paradigm, like the paradigm, like go back to antiquity, where the father was the hunter. He went out into the world and he brought home the raw material, and his mother, she develops the raw material. Like the Gemara says, the husband brings home wheat, it's the mother who, to the wife who turns it into bread. He brings home the raw materials, she develops the raw materials. You know, the hunter-developer paradigm. The point, by the way, is not, it doesn't matter if this, in fact, is the case today or not. Like, I know everybody, people get their back up and find it sexist, and it's not, it doesn't fit into the 21st century. It's not even the point. First of all, I'm not so sure that the paradigms are shed entirely. There's the idea of, there are certain traditional roles that no matter how people try to shake or change tradition, it just bounces back to what it is, because there's something inherent about it. But whatever, it's like that's not the point here at all. I'm not trying to convince you of that. The point that Rabbeinu Bachaya is simply using is he's using the paradigm of the reality as it was in his day. But what you can see from the paradigm, which is not hard to understand, is that the level of trust or the way you place your trust changes by virtue of understanding the situation. And as you understand differently, as your perception widens, your trust begins to change. And that actually is his point. That's the whole point that he wants to make. Like the Tevel Levonin says, Yisrin Yidiyosam, Yedim Umevinim Tachlis Memshalte. The way they'll understand Hashem is the way they're going to trust in Hashem. It all depends on that understanding. And the metaphor is in how people's trust changes in accordance with their perception. So the child found security in his mother's breasts. Then he finds security in his mother. And now moving forward, so if you're in the Kihat book, you got to turn the page to 243 now. And as the child now begins to grow, and as his perception now deepens, and his understanding further develops, what happens is, Roya, he sees, Kian Hogas Imay El Aviv, that who does his mother place her trust in? The child sees in the father, that the woman, the mother, feels vulnerable. And when the mother has the father or the husband around, that she feels secure. He's the protector. Or as they say in the modern vernacular, he could schlep the luggage. He's somebody to schlep the luggage. He's there. The child notices that. Children are very, very clever. Children pick up on things that we would never believe. So the child perceives this. And the moment the child's perception changes, because he's a little bit older, and now he understands things differently, he sees that his mother's ability to care for him is based on his father's ability to provide, because the father's the provider. So he says, look, I'm putting my trust in my mother, but really she puts her trust or her ability to provide for me is coming from my father. So now he's moving on, not to place his trust in his father. Now all of a sudden he's placing his trust. When does he feel most secure? Dad is home. Dad is around. Now he's secure when dad is around. Now, it's very interesting that the language here, if you look at the language for the trust that he places in his mother, so it says the baby places a trust because l'roiv hashgachasa olav, because of her supervision, because she's involved with his life. When he talks about the next level, he says ukshetechzach hakarasa yoid, meshiv bitchoinoi el olav l'mailos hagonosoi. Not his supervision, but his protection. Not his supervision, his protection. So the Paslechem, who, you know, he really goes into the detailed, nuanced language over here. He says, Be'imoi, it said hashgachasa. It said her supervision. And with the trust of the father, he's speaking about protection. And he says, that's because the small child understands that at the end of the day, who is really going to be with him, who is in tune with his needs, who understands him, who is mashgiach alav, who supervises, his mother. The father's there when you need him. He's the protector. Is there an occasion? He makes sure that they're not vulnerable, that they're shielded. But ultimately, it's not the same hashgacha. The child understands that it's his mother who's involved in those little details. So, But the perception has changed. The perception has changed. With the child who felt 100% at ease and tranquil when his mother was around, as he gets older, now feels vulnerable and exposed. And the opposite of tranquil and at peace when his father's away. Only when his father's home does he feel that security. He's secure because his father's there. And then, so little children, they think that their parents are able to take care of them. And as long as the parents are there, the parents are going to be there for them, and the parents shield them, and the parents protect them. And then what happens? Then the children all of a sudden grow up. They become teenagers. And all of a sudden, they didn't need the parents. And one mother once told me, my son, she said to me, he loved his parents, he loved his mom. All of a sudden became a teenager. He'd say, Mom, drop me off here. I'll walk the last block to school. All of a sudden, he was embarrassed of being seen with me. I was like an embarrassment to him. She said it was like a very swift change. All of a sudden, the teenager is all on his own. He's independent. I can do this all by myself. I don't need Mommy and Daddy to come and clean up for me. I don't want to have Mommy and Daddy holding my hand and shielding me and protecting me. So all of a sudden, now he moves on. This is the fourth level. So Rabbi Bechai says, Kasha Yechzak Gufay. He becomes a little bigger, a little stronger. V'titochen lei tachbula. And he starts to develop his own strategies for life. He's able to figure out how to deal with his own problems, so to speak. He doesn't run home and screaming, Mommy, Mommy, take care of me or do something for me. He's going to be a mama's boy. At a certain point, he's not screaming, Daddy, either. He's going to, I'll take care of myself. And then he gets a little older, and he starts making his way into the business world. And he's b'michyase, b'melacha, ischeira. He's making his own living. He doesn't need a roof over his head anymore. He's providing his own roof, whether he's doing menial labor or he's engaged in commerce or a profession. Ba'adeimalem. So now, who does he think? Who does he place his trust in? Myself. You take care of me. Mom and Dad, you take care of me. I take care of myself. He places his trust in his own strength. He places his trust in his own acumen, in his own wisdom and ingenuity and strategy. And this is all mipnei sichlusei. This is actually an extremely foolish thing. We already talked about this in the previous episode, that sichlus is not stupid, but rather ignorance. He's very smart, but he's very ignorant. And he's ignorant, b'chol asher kodem b'tevas hanhagos alikim. He thinks that his mommy was taking care of him. He thinks his daddy was taking care of him. Who took care of him all along? Hashem took care of him. No, but he doesn't think so. So in his juvenile infancy, he thought that it was mother's breasts were taking care of him. That's all he wanted. Just wanted to suckle. Then he got a little smarter. He realized it's not about suckling, it's about his mother. His mother protects him. Then he got a little smarter, and he realized that his mother is relying on the father for protection. So now when the father's around, he feels that his father's protecting him. And then he got so smart, and now he realized he could protect himself. But in truth, he's ignorant of the fact that all along, up until this point, who was protecting him and who was providing for him? HaKadosh Baruch Hu was doing all those things. So if you think about it, we just went through four levels, and there's no trust in Hashem whatsoever. So why is Rabbeinu B'chaya telling us about four levels of no trust in Hashem? Because in the four levels, what you see is how perception changes betachin. Forget that it's misplaced betachin. Let's leave aside the fact that it's not trust in Hashem, but you're placing your trust in something. And the placing of the trust depends on your own perceptions changing, your own understanding of circumstances. A little child thinks that his father is like the most amazing creature walks the face of the earth. Kids, little kids worship their father. Then they become teenagers. They don't worship us anymore. They start laughing at us. They're embarrassed of us. And they move past that. And they start relying on themselves. But the truth is that all of this is a tragic mistake. Now, Rabbeinu B'chaya is not finished. He's going to go through a fifth level of who people place their trust in. And then he says all of a sudden they crash. All of a sudden they realize that the people they're placing their trust in can't actually deliver. All of a sudden they come to this awareness and realization that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is running the show. But even that is in a very limited fashion. But that's when we get to level 6. But before we go to level 5, Rabbeinu B'chaya slips a story in here. He slips a story in. It's a very strange story. Very strange story. It's a story that seems almost harsh. Let's look at it together, and I'll tell you why it's like very difficult to understand and what I think the pshat is. So the story is told about one of the chassidim. In some versions, it doesn't say chassidim. In some versions, it says tzaddikim. One of the tzaddikim. It's in this... In this Hebrew version of Hamavur La'ir Achsidus, he brings down that the story happened not with a chassid, but with a tzaddik. And of course, I'm going to ask you, what's the difference? Chassid, tzaddik, why does he even say it that way? And he had a neighbor. He had a neighbor. And the neighbor was a soifir mohir. A soifir mohir was an expert scribe. Expert. Fantastic scribe. And because he was a fantastic scribe, he made a good living. He was talented. He had what they call in Yiddish golden hand. He had golden hands. I mean, he could do anything. He could write, he was a calligrapher, and he made a very good parnasa. Vayim misparnas, mischar sifrusa. He's making a living off his calligraphy. Okay, what happened? So what happens is, Amar lo yeh mechad, this one of these great chassidim or tzaddik said to him one day, "Hey, echin yenecha, how's life? How's it going?" And he said, "Amar lo yeh betayv, everything's great." He said. He said, "Be'oid yodi shleima, as long as I have my golden hands, everything's great, because I can make a living and I pay my way. As long as I have my hands, I'm great." What happened? Ule'erev hayeim ahu nigda'o yodei. And that very night, all of a sudden, he lost his hands. So the word nigda usually means severed. That's usually what it means. In the Kiyat edition, they translate it as... hand was crushed. I have no idea how the Hebrew word nigda comes to crushed. Nigda definitely does not mean crushed. But others maintain that it doesn't mean physically lost his hand, but his hand lost its dexterity. He wasn't able to, whatever. Maybe he had a stroke, God forbid. I don't know what he had. He couldn't do what he was doing until now. V'leikosav bashar yomav. That was it. He never wrote again. And Bnei B'chaya says, "V'hoi is a onshe me'akel yizbarach, asher batach al yodei." This was like a punishment, a consequence, because he relied on his hands. So, first of all, why is Bnei B'chaya slipping the story in? What does it have to do with? I mean, he's going somewhere with this. Why does he slip it in here? Number one. Number two, this whole thing sounds like a setup. The chassid came to him and says, "How's life? How you doing?" The guy said, "Great, I have golden hands. Everything's great. It's golden." So what do you have to ask him a question for? You set him up for that. And why did you chide him? Why don't you say, "Listen, don't speak like that. Everything comes from Hashem if you're such a big chassid." And like, so a person said that he makes a good living because he has golden hands, so for this he deserves to have his hand chopped off? Or his hand crushed or ruined or mangled? Like, really? A lack of betochen means you lose your limbs? It doesn't seem fair. It's a little bit of a harsh punishment for a guy who didn't have betochen. Especially because, like, you know, most people, even if they go around saying Baruch Hashem and Bezos Hashem, they actually think like this guy. Most people think like that. Most think, "How's life? Oh, everything's great because I have, you know, this ability to make a living. As long as I have this ability." That's unfortunately the vast majority of people. There aren't that many big betochen people. Who are we fooling? And even when we learn about betochen and we want them, and it's very hard to maintain that mindfulness. So the guy said what everybody thinks. Because of that, he got his hands chopped off. Like it really doesn't seem fair at all. So I would like to suggest a whole like different pshat. I mean, I'm a little uncomfortable because it doesn't say this anywhere. It doesn't say, none of the mefarshim really speak about this. None of them ask the question, none of them answer the question. Which is strange to me altogether. Why don't they ask or answer this question? What's the trajectory of Rabbeinu B'chaya? What's the reason for the story? What's even the reason? What's the if it was a chassid who asked the question? Who cares? Why do you say there was a person who made a good living and he said, "V'hayo aimer," that this is all because of my hands. He would go around boasting about his hands. You know how many people I meet that boast about their wherewithal or ability? And that's why? I'm so smart, that's why I'm a millionaire. I'm so diligent. I'm so skilled. People do this all the time. Why do you have to like make the story? V'omru al echad min achsidim, they said, "Baba maisa." V'omru, they said. You don't have to go to a once upon a time story. Just look in the mirror and you'll get the story. this is how most people think. So there was a terrible terrorist attack in northern Israel in May of 1974. I think it was May 15th. And some of you, maybe you're old enough to remember that in a place called Maalot, there was these monsters. They broke into a home, they killed three members of the family, slaughtered a family, and then they went to a school. And the school had 100 children who were sleeping there from an overnight. They'd gone camping or something, and they were sleeping in the school building. So like, I think like 20 escaped jumping out the windows, but there was like 60 or 70, like with a very large amount of teachers and counselors and school children, teenagers who were stuck. And they wanted a release of PFL prisoners. And Israel actually agreed. But this was coming, it was like being coordinated at Damascus, and somehow the codes didn't reach Damascus. And they threatened that a certain time comes, they're slaughtering the children, Rahman al-San. A very tragic story. So the Sayeret Matkal launched a rescue, and they killed all the terrorists. But unfortunately, the terrorists had booby-trapped, and in their dying throes, they used grenades and automatic weapons, and they murdered 21 school children. It was a terrible story. It demoralized the entirety of the country. And the Rebbe, a short while earlier, had started the mitzvah campaign of mezuzah to make sure that mezuzahs were kosher. And somebody went to the school and took down the mezuzahs. So initially there were 17 children reported killed. They found 17 mezuzahs that weren't kosher. And then later they found out there was actually 21. So another four. And they found another four mezuzahs that weren't kosher. Freaky stuff. And the Rebbe said something was pushing me to start this campaign, the mezuzah, which says brings protection. And I didn't know what it was. I didn't know what was pushing me to try to increase the protection of the Jewish people. And now it becomes clear. So the Rebbe was attacked in the press. People who love to attack Torah and mitzvahs, and they said, how ridiculous, the Rebbe is saying that people died, that children died, because they didn't have a kosher mezuzah. I was a very small boy, I'm 3 years old. I have no recollection of this, but I only know from what I read. So this was 2 weeks before Shavuos. At the Shavuos Verbrengen, the Rebbe was like very much pained by these attacks. He was very hurt. The Rebbe said that he never suggested, Chas V'Shalom, that people died because there wasn't a kosher mezuzah. And so why does a terrible thing like this happen, that children are murdered al Kiddush Hashem? So the Rebbe said, the answer is, we don't know. We don't know. The Rebbe cited the Gemara and Brachas and Daf Yud, Bahadei Kavshu D'Rachamon Lamalach. This is not something for us to try and figure out. Some things are not for us to figure out. We don't understand certain things. This is Hashem's secrets. But what we do see, the Rebbe says, is that it says about the mezuzah that Hashem yishmor tzeischa uvayecha, that Hashem guards you and Hashem shields you. So it says about the mezuzah. It says that. Kasha yeitzim l'derech, azay yesh tzeirech b'shmir b'nei alistim. When you're going out to travel, you need to be guarded. How do you get guarded? Like in antiquity, when people go on a trip somewhere, there was these marauding bands of robbers. How do you stay safe? But derech hateva, like in natural means, what do you do? The answer is you arm yourself. You have kli neshek. And what if people go out unprotected? They're not wearing protective gear, and they don't have weapons, and they go to a place where rachmanu litzlan, there's danger. So what's going to happen? You open yourself to the possibility that if God forbid there's an attack, there's going to be devastating results. And the Rebbe said that the place where the children went out of, there was mezuzahs psulis. And the Rebbe said, you cannot dismiss that. In the beginning, the Rebbe said there was 17 missing. They found 17 pasul mezuzahs. And then when they found that there was another four missing, they found that there's actually another four pasul mezuzahs. You can't dismiss that. It's chilling. And the Rebbe said, the family that was murdered, they found there was no kosher mezuzahs there also. And the Rebbe went on to say, it's not the pshat, chas v'shalom, this is why it happens. The Rebbe said that when we have protection in place, it can shield and protect us. On another occasion, the Rebbe said, if a soldier goes out to battle without a helmet and he gets hit, God forbid, in the head, he doesn't say that you know why he died? Because the helmet killed him. The lack of the helmet killed him. No, the enemy bullets killed him. But he had even taken the precaution and worn the helmet, he would have been protected. In other words, the mitzvah is able to shield and protect us. Even if something bad is going to happen, if we have the protective measures in place, that will shield and protect us. That's what I'm glossing over, but that's a story that happened in 1974. So I was thinking about this story here, and this is my suggestion. I think that this chassid was not just anybody. Person with what we call Ruach HaKodesh, person with higher consciousness. And the chassid had this premonition that this person was slated for something which wasn't good. So he wanted to help him to shield himself. What's the most powerful thing that a Yid could do to bring Hashem's bracha? Even when it isn't, so to speak, in the cards. He could have betochen. Have betochen. as we learned in the beginning of the Shara B'tochen, that when a person has B'tochen, when you place your trust in Hashem, that brings the bracha. And as the Rebbe famously explained, that the words of the Tzemach Tzedek, tracht gut v'zayin gut, think good will be good, is not a Hebraic or a rabbinic version of positive thoughts and positive thinking. Tracht gut means you place your trust in Hashem. There's a famous story that there was a young man from Israel. He was studying in yeshiva in New York, and he got a message that his father had a heart attack, and it's a very, very critical situation. And he immediately dashed off a note to the Rebbe, and he wrote, "I don't know what to think." And the Rebbe answered him back immediately, "You don't know what to think? You should think positive and put your trust in Hashem." Which he did. He had such a sharp answer. He did. And later on, he received word that things turned around and that the critical circumstances, the really, really critical time kind of passed, and that his father was on the mend. So he came running to the Rebbe's office. This is like in the early 50s. There's a video of it. The guy tells the story. Came running to the Rebbe's office to say that the Rebbe asked his secretary to ask this fellow, "When did things change? When did things change?" And it turned out, when he started thinking positive, placing his trust in Hashem, that actually made the difference. It's exactly then that things changed around.
Does it change? Well, we don't know. I'll take back the question.
Could it change things?
No.
Yes?
Change the outcome? Or does it change your perspective?
No, it could change the outcome. Putting your trust in Hashem changes the outcome. So this is what I'm going to tell you is a documented story, and I've shared it many times. It's documented. It's a famous story that Ariel Sharon was in the Rebbe's study for Yechidus, private. The Rebbe asks him, "When are you going back to Israel?" And he tells the Rebbe, "Tonight." And the Rebbe says, "I don't think it's a good idea. You shouldn't go tonight." And incredibly, Ariel Sharon didn't go. The Rebbe said not to go. He was not exactly, the biggest chassid, as they say. And the Rebbe said not to go. He didn't go. And that plane was an Alitalia plane. It was hijacked by Palestinian terrorists. And guess who they were looking for? Ariel Sharon. Because they knew they had the manifesto, the flight manifesto. They knew he was going to be on the plane. And in the end, Baruch Hashem, everybody was released. I think some kind of rescue, but everybody was released in the end. So Ariel Sharon was really freaked out because he felt the Rebbe saved his life. They were on the plane. They wanted him. They're after him. So he came back to the Rebbe, and he said, "If the Rebbe knew the plane was going to be hijacked, why didn't the Rebbe tell me? And we could have caught the hijackers." And the Rebbe said to him, "I didn't know the plane was going to be hijacked." So Mr. Sharon said to the Rebbe, "Then why did you tell me not to take the flight?" So the Rebbe said to him that I learned to trust my instincts. When you told me that you're taking a plane tonight, a very, very cold uneasiness overcame me. So I told you I don't think you should go. Now, what exactly that means and how much did the Rebbe really share what he knew or didn't know, I don't know. I'm just what do I know? I'm just a regular guy. But tzaddikim can have awareness of certain things. Ruach HaKodesh doesn't have to mean that the tzaddik sees with perfect clarity exactly what's going on. There are many stories of tzaddikim where tzaddikim have an awareness in the way that they have. They have something called a higher consciousness and awareness. I think that Ariel Sharon's betochen, his amunas tzaddikim as it's called, is trusting. The Rebbe said don't go. He didn't go. I think that did change things around for him. I think it literally did change things around. And we hear, think about it for a moment. You hear, God forbid, somebody is sick, somebody's in trouble. What's your first reaction? You're a Torah Jew. What's your first reaction?
It wasn't me. Glad it wasn't me.
No, that's not your first reaction.
No, but that's...
You're going to daven.
I'm not saying not me. I'm just saying...
You're going to daven. What's your first reaction? You're going
to
daven.
Yeah, talk to Hashem.
What do you talk to Hashem? What do you think that's going to change things? Hmm? What do you think that's going to change anything? Hashem's going to do whatever Hashem wants.
Yes.
We don't say that. We say we could pray. We say we could do mitzvahs. We believe that the Torah we study, the mitzvahs we perform, the prayers we offer can make a difference. Torah Semes tells us that that's what we're supposed to do. In fact, the Gemara says if you have a cholah b'bayit, somebody sick in the house, you should go to a sage and ask the sage to pray for you. Because he's a better davener. I don't know, closer to Hashem. The story is told that Rabbi Yechiel ben Zakkai was the leader of the Jewish people, like he was the Rebbe. And this was a story in the house, and he said, go to Chanina ben Deisa, ask Chanina to pray. So they said to Rabbi Yechiel, what's going on over here? Chanina ben Deisa should pray? Like, well, you're Rabbi Yechiel ben Zakkai, you're the leader of the Sanhedrin. And Rabbi Yechiel said that I am like a sar lefnei ha-melech. I'm like an officer, a senior cabinet minister. It doesn't just walk in and out. He says, Chanina is like an attendant. He's in and out all the time. It's different levels of different tzaddikim who can pray in different ways. There is such a thing.
That's why we go to the Rebbe.
Exactly. That's why we go to the oil. That's why we dive. That's exactly what we're talking about. So one of the key elements of being able to change the future in a positive way is having betochen. So Rabbi Nebuchai slips it right in over here. He says, this guy, he's all about Almighty Me. And he says, by the way, v'amar alechem min hachasidim, that he came to this person, and he said, how you doing? And my read on this is, he said, heich in yonecha, because he was hoping to bring forth from him, the person should say, Baruch Hashem. Mm-hmm. The person should place his trust in Hashem. He was trying, because this is what tzaddikim do. This is what real Hasidim, the great Hasidim did. They tried to bring forth a profusion of faith in the person. Try to pull it out of the person. Unfortunately, it didn't work. Amar Leh Toiv, I'm great, my hands. This is gold. My hands, as long as I have my hands, I'm great. And the Chassid thought to himself, Nabach, that's sad. Because the next day, he didn't have his hands anymore. That's my read on the story. Yeah, so I mean, this is the way it makes sense to me. Otherwise, like I said, there's three problems with the story. The first is, why do we get the first part of the story? What's the difference? Amru al echad. The chassid said, well, who cares what he said to him? The main thing is what he said, what he answered. So who cares what he asked? Who asked? So you could say, anybody asked him how he's doing. Why a chassid or a tzaddik? So that's number one. Number two, the punishment is not fair. I don't think it's a punishment per se. I think the word is consequence. The consequence, that's the word. It was a consequence. And number three, what does this have to do with the trajectory of this lesson where he's going through levels? The answer is it seems it doesn't. But I think Rabbi Nebuchai feels very, very compelled to insert it over here. It's almost like this. It's almost like level 1, 2, and 3, you cannot blame the child. If a child finds comfort and security in his mother's breasts, he's just that's a baby.
Yeah, they're
wired that way. The baby's wired, right. A little child is just at ease when his mother. As long as he's with his mother, he's at ease. He's separated, he gets anxious. This is also, like, so the child's wired that way. The child doesn't know the difference. Later on, he realizes that his mother is anxious unless his father's around. When the father's around, the mother's relaxed. So he becomes relaxed because his father relies on his father. Thinks his father's God, so to speak. Relies on his father. He also, there's not, what do you want? That's a kid. So a kid thinks his father could shave him. You know what it becomes an issue? Now he's bar mitzvah. Now she's bat mitzvah. Now they're done with their parents. And then they start thinking, it's Almighty Me. This is where the problems begin. This is where the lack of betochen actually sets in. And that's where Rabbi Nebuchai slips the story and he said, V'amra lechod, the person who relied on himself, that was the big problem. So this is where we have to, that's where you start working on betochen. It's almost like the small child doesn't know the difference. He's too innocent. He's born innocent. It's when the children lose their innocence, they hit puberty, they lose their innocence. All of a sudden, they're aware. It's like when the child is very, very small, so in, like we say, kenafshi gomel olai, so the Eretz HaChaim says something very interesting. He says, The little child, einim was bayish lefnei ima ili his galus. The child doesn't feel naked. He doesn't blush when his mother changes his diaper. He doesn't know that he's naked. The little child doesn't know that his parents are giving him a bath. They get uncomfortable because it's not. But then all of a sudden they get a little older, and then that sets in. He says that was the innocence. He says that's the kind of, Eretz HaChaim says that's the innocence of this verse of Tillim. How innocent we should be before HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Yitzi's asking, it doesn't say who it was, you probably mean to write. It only says that he was He was a chassid, yeah. He was echad min hachassidim, not just one ordinary person. He was somebody extraordinary. I told you, in the other version it says a tzaddik. In the Shaar B'tochen L'Eir HaChassidus, I don't know where they get their translation from, but over here it translates it as Kvar Omru Ka'achad HaTzaddikim Hayole Shochen. So probably the original is like the original Hebrew Arabic is somewhere between an extraordinarily pious person, which could be translated either as a chassid or as a tzaddik. Then what happens, and this is like rung 5, Ve'im yitochen lo yitarpe yadezu losim in abriyas. Then all of a sudden, so what happens? People realize they're not omnipotent or almighty, who to have to like curry favor with this rich person and that rich person, and I have to be good connections here, and this one, this was my boss, and this is the person who can get me a job. You start to rely on others. So the person says, oh, I'm good because I know so-and-so. Or so-and-so promised me, so I'm very calm. I'm good because, you know, my rich uncle, my rich friend, I made a really good impression on this person. I know everything's going to be fine for me. Instead of put your trust in others. And v'tenuach nafshe aleihem. As long as they're around and they promise me, oh, now I have nothing to worry about. As the Pas Lechem says, so now we're going back to chayzer u'mesaper b'tochen ha'odom. He's going back to the trust, people-oriented trust. Meaning the object of the trust is people. And he shows, eichun netek me'inyan el inyan me'imeyaldusi. You see how things are changing from his earliest age. So in the beginning, the baby trusts his mother's breasts. Then he trusts his mother. Then he trusts his father. Then he finds trust in himself. Then he realizes he's not so cool, and he's not so capable, and he's not so able. And he starts trusting in other people. So his own, he's afraid. He's afraid to go out there in the big bad world. But this somebody very powerful, somebody very wealthy, somebody very capable, somebody very, very well positioned, promised him. Now he's good. He's relaxed. Why? So I got a guarantee. I'm good. But the guarantee is not worth the paper it's written on. You don't know what's going to be afterwards. But we don't think like that. And how many people tend to think that way? How many people tend to place their trust? They were nervous, I was worried, and now I got a guarantee. The doctor told me I'm going to live. What is he, God? So-and-so promised me he's going to take care of me. You can't take care of himself necessarily. As we learned earlier, is he here today, gone tomorrow? So the point is, once again, that this fifth level is the person, he puts himself at ease and he's calm and tranquil because he put his trust into somebody else. But we see over the 5 levels, the 5 rungs, that we're climbing this ladder of trust, that we see that the person keeps placing his trust in different levels or different people. And it's what changes from one level to the next? What changes? Perception, understanding, awareness. First, the baby understands that it's not breasts that are feeding him, that it's his mother who's feeding him. Then he understands that it's his father who's the provider. Then he realizes, I don't need my father and mother. I'm my provider. Then he realizes, maybe I'm not my provider. But I have good friends. They're my providers. Those are the 5 levels. The 5 levels change by virtue of maturity and understanding. So our comprehension of the circumstances necessarily change and shift our attitudes and who we place our trust in. And now Rabbeinu Bechaya has positioned us now to start actually talking about trust in Hashem. So now, levels 6 through 10, the next 5, the second 5 of the second 5 rungs of the ladder, now he's going to go through the levels of trust and show us that the more we understand and have a comprehension about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the deeper and more profound is our level of trust in Him. That's where we'll stop for today. And Be'ezus Hashem Yisbarach, next week we'll continue from there. Thank you for joining. Yashar Koyach. Thank you. And thank all of you. Please share. If you haven't yet, please subscribe. And I look forward to seeing you back. Laila Tov, Kol Tov.